Here's a dilemma for you.
Welcome to Dilemma! And welcome to Dilemma, the show where we explore the big moral and ethical questions by asking silly questions to people. I'm Sue Perkins, and tonight I'll be posing such quandaries as, is £250,000 really enough compensation for spending a year with Alan Sugar? Is it wrong to steal if what you steal is Sarah Palin's Enormo Moose Gun? And if Piers Morgan's house was below sea level, would you still care about climate change? Joining me this week is the comedian who is the writer and star of Radio 4's Richard Herring's Objective, and if you need me to tell you who that is, you're really not paying enough attention. The actress and writer Rebecca Front, who you've heard recently in Radio 4's Incredible Women, she played the women. A columnist for the Sunday Times and The Independent, we've let him on so he doesn't expose my super injunction, Dominic Lawson, and a comedian and jockey of discs who recently wrote a book about playing strange games with strange people, so he should fit right in here tonight, Dave Gorman. Okay, now to start off with, we're going to pose some purely hypothetical situations to our panellists to see in which direction their compasses point. Richard, starting with you, suppose your grandfather brought home a few trinkets from the war and you decide to sell them on an online auction website. Just trinkets, flags, posters, skulls, nothing weird. Now the winning bid comes in and you realise from the winning bidder's username that he is a Nazi sympathiser. Do you still sell him the goods?
Well, are the goods Nazi-based goods?
There's an element there in that the Nazis were involved. My history's limited, but the Nazis were very much involved with that conflict.
Well, you know, you can't, if you're selling Nazi memorabilia over the internet, you kind of expect that probably will be bought by a Nazi, don't you? I mean, I think if you go, I'm selling this, but it must be bought by someone with no interest in Nazi Germany or no...
By deciding
to sell the things in the first place, surely I've abnegated the responsibility to decide who purchases them.
So you're now saying that it's fine, even though you've seen his username come up?
Yeah,
Adolf 1. Did I not mention that?
That could be any Adolf.
And you're using...
Could be, I was going to say Adolf Eichmann, that isn't much better.
No.
Can I argue that actually a Nazi sympathiser could do a great deal of ill with a large amount of money if he chose to?
That is true.
And actually, I would rather he had some worthless trinkets that only he could worship and not the money with which he could do real evil.
You would have no problem, basically.
I would be uncomfortable about selling stuff to a Nazi.
Really?
But I would still sell them, so I got the money.
So you're not bothered by the
How much money is it?
It's an awful lot of money.
Okay, I'll take it.
Okay. When I say money, actually he's going to pay in gold bars. And you'll have to bring them into a bank.
I don't know if morally you have a right to criticise someone in this circumstance for their political choices. So if you start saying, I'm not going to sell anything to anyone because I disagree with their political values, then you are as bad as the Nazi.
But if you don't start judging people, you're lost in a moral vacuum where you don't stand either side of the fence.
If you have come full circle and become a Nazi just like him, then you might as well just give him the goods and take the money because it's just two Nazi sympathisers to go. It's all right.
Maybe just sympathise with them because they lost the war. Go, oh, bad luck.
Okay, well, Godwin's law says the debate is over when you start talking about Nazis. I think the last 10 minutes of our lives have proved we really should have listened to that law. Rebecca, you're next. Imagine an elderly uncle is racist towards a very old, a very treasured friend of yours at a family gathering. Do you say something?
Oh, yes.
Definitely?
Yes.
But he's an old man.
Well, I might say it quietly.
Then he won't hear you. He's an old man.
That was sort of the idea.
You'd have to beg. Oh, I see. So you don't really want the point to get through. You just want to make a pretense for the point getting through.
Now, I probably would say something. I might say it in a slightly ineffectual way, like, ooh, I don't think you should say that. You know, that sort of really annoying, slightly passive-aggressive thing. I'd probably do that.
So you'd sort of treat it like a children's TV presenter, would you?
Very much.
OK, so you're pretty absolute about that?
Yes.
What if it was a nice thing to say? I mean, a positive stereotype. Did I point out your friend's Welsh? All your uncle said is basically, you know, you've got a lovely
voice.
You've got
a lovely
singing voice.
Like
all of your kind.
It would be. Yes. Given that my oldest, dearest friend, who is Welsh, actually does have a lovely singing voice, it would be difficult to dispute that. Unless he's actually said, you filthy Welshie, you've got a lovely singing voice, in which case I'd say, don't call her that because she's my friend.
Well, I mean, there's kids there. I mean, you'd have to bellow into this old man's tired ears. The children would start crying and the tears would just leak into the cake and the cake would just fall apart in a river of sadness and inappropriate name-calling.
Kids these days, quite rightly, have racism drummed into them at school. I don't mean racism drummed into them. My children go to state school. They do not have racism drummed into them.
Wow.
But they have an awareness of racism drummed into them.
Yes.
To the point where actually most of the children I know think everything is racist. Like the other day, sort of said, I'm not sure which cardigan to wear. Maybe the black? Oh, that's racist. It's a black cardigan. Should I wear the black cardigan? Bit racist, Mum. So you do have to say something. I think you do have to say that's not really appropriate.
He doesn't mean any harm. Look into his watery blue eyes. It's just there's kindness there, Rebecca.
Yeah.
Is it all about you? Is it all about you forcing your glib, politically correct views at a party situation to make yourself look cool?
Yeah, it is.
Would you say something, Dominic?
Well, it would depend if he was a collector of Nazi insignia.
If it was a very old person, I mean, do you think sometimes age is comes to bear on these sort of decisions?
Yeah. Besides, I mean, if it's a question of causing offence, I wouldn't want to cause offence to the poor, old, roomy-eyed, 95-year-old relative.
Ah. So you're saying there's a sort of cut-off point for racism. So, you know... when are you allowed to be racist? 60, 65? Get your bus pass? And a licence to abuse people of different cultural heritages?
Yeah, you would develop a slide rule and it would have the age on one side and the amount of racism on the other.
OK. So you could begin in your 50s to be sort of benign but casually racist.
Yes, I'm now 54.
And how's that working for you?
I'm benign and casual.
It's good to know. Dave, how old are you and where are you on Dominic's sliding scale of casual racism?
I'm delighted that he's invented one. I look forward to him going on Dragon's Den. But I'm out.
OK, well, that's racism sorted out. No need to thank us. Thank Rebecca, who's dealt with that in one fell swoop. Now, Dominic, would you give an alibi to somebody you hate? To stress, you know that he is innocent, but no one else was there, so you could let that person go to prison.
Yes, I would give an alibi.
No one else saw you, though. I mean, this is finely nuanced. I mean, you have a history with this guy. He stole your first girlfriend, second, third. He just can't wait to take everything that's yours.
He's got very bad taste, isn't
he? He's got... It's churlish of you and beneath your standards. But he's not a decent person. You know, for example, that he, you know, was drink driving just a few years before. Nobody got him for that. I mean, he could have endangered anybody's life. He's not a good person. This is your chance to put a ne'er-do-well away. It's only, he might get 6 weeks. He might not even get a custodial sentence. He might do community service. He might just sweep some leaves.
But it is the case that you never humiliate someone so much that you don't like as when you do him a favour.
So you're going to kill with kindness?
Well, I think it would be very humiliating for him, actually, if I were to do this man a favour, after all the women he'd taken. He didn't have so many, actually.
He said thousands, but he may well have been overestimating.
Yeah.
I mean, you're a sap, Dominic, is what you're saying. You're going to let this man walk over you again and again and again. Enough is enough. Make a stand.
Okay.
Put him away.
OK, I tell you what. This is an extreme case, OK? Yeah. I would give him an alibi, but I would try very hard to appear to the court as a very unreliable witness.
Deeply duplicitous. So you would presumably just pour alcohol over yourself, slur.
Yes.
I think is the most rational and intelligent answer we could possibly get. So basically, he gets 6 months, and you get to
clear.
Say, well, I did my best.
I did my best.
Well, I think you've certainly covered that one. And if the police are listening, this was recorded months ago, so Dominic can't claim he was with us when that thing happened. Dave, it's late at night. You've been at a wedding and you've missed the last train home. An ex-girlfriend offers to let you sleep on the floor of her hotel room. Your current partner hates your ex-girlfriend and did not come to the wedding because she knew that she was going to be there. Do you wait at the train station until the first train in the morning, 7 hours from now, or do you accept the invitation and sleep on that dreaded ex's floor?
I am a very happily married man, and I would not go back to an ex-girlfriend's hotel room. I would sleep rough on the train station platform.
But you know that, I mean, nothing's going to happen. I mean, you...
I know that nothing's going to happen, but I know it would hurt the feelings of a woman I care greatly about.
Of course. So you're going to... Nobody wants wants an R in a panel show. Oh, nobody wants that.
You've only just got married, Dave Gorman. You only just care greatly. I care greatly for my wife. You've got to love her passionately, not care
adore
greatly.
Adore her.
All of the above, yes.
Now, the train station. You approach it and you've made your decision. I think it's the right decision. It's certainly really tugged at the audience's heartstrings. And there's a lovely bench. You go, oh, I'll sleep on that bench. And just as you approach it, a tramp decides to just urinate. There's this little thin slick of wee on the bench there. You know, this is going to be... You're not going to sleep at all. So would you still go to sleep there, or would you just wander around the streets?
I have, on one occasion in my life, slept rough. And what I did was try to bed down every sort of half hour and then go to a 24-hour garage and buy a cup of coffee and then wander back to the park and then go and get another coffee. I did that all night. And that's what I would end up doing under these circumstances.
You'd rather do that than just take up a simple offer from an ex-girlfriend. She's got over you, Dave. I mean, the arrogance. The idea you still feel you have sway, emotional sway over this. But 10 years ago, she's moved on, Dave. I suggest you do the same.
I know that full well. But my wife does not know that.
Your wife.
You put it in the original question. It's someone that my current partner hates. And I'm only doing this not out of any cocky, well, obviously she wants to sleep with me sense, but out of love for someone who you acknowledged would be upset if I shared a room with that person.
I'm actually just disgusted with you, Dave, for going to that wedding without your wife in the first place. I'm disgusted with the way you've behaved.
I mean, you are really on your... And there's a blizzard. Did I say there was a blizzard?
No, you had neglected to mention the blizzard.
Well, it's just come in. I mean, these weather fronts can move very, very quickly. And I'm no trained meteorologist.
Can I ask a very indelicate question? I mean, your wife doesn't know, does she?
What, that you'll be sleeping in the hotel?
No. I mean, and nothing happens, does it?
That's up to you, Dominic.
It's not, strictly speaking, just up to Dominic.
It's never been just up to me.
It definitely has to be up to somebody else as well.
Your wife will never, ever, ever know.
Fine. These are the conditions, and you're not changing these conditions. No one ever finds out. Nothing happens. Yes, of course, I'm thinking the room. But you're going to change it now, and you know you are! You know you are, Perkins! You know you are!
So you've gone back to her room. And just, you notice, just by the bed as you're falling asleep, and you are on the floor, you haven't touched her, you've been good, Dave, righteous Gorman, everything as you say, I'm not messing with your mind. Just as you fall asleep, you notice that she's got a picture of you and your wife by the bed with die. Die. Written over your wife's face in what may or may not be rabbit's blood. Still sleeping the night there on the hotel floor?
I think you call room service. Quickly.
Or you suffocate your ex-girlfriend and take her out and drop her at a train station, and she was the person who didn't get a hotel room that night. She was the one who got left out. She's murderous, we know this. She's plotting to take my wife's life. I would feel okay about that.
Is the correct answer. Well done, Dave. OK, and at the end of that round, I'm going to give the moral high ground to Dominic. Congratulations, Dominic. Right, so now it comes to the round we call Beg for Your Life. I'm going to erase somebody completely from history, a concept familiar to anyone who's let their parents borrow their computer. And the panellists must argue the case for the historical figure we've given them. We shall decide who stays and goes by way of a simple audience cheer. Now, Richard, can you please, first of all, make the case to save Silvio Berlusconi?
Yes, we can. I'm Silvio Berlusconi. I think you have to save me because I'm a big character. There aren't many political characters. I keep things interesting. If I'm not at the next G8 meeting, who else is going to stuff €20 into Michelle Obama's bra and ask for a lap dance? That's the kind of thing that keeps thousands of jobs rely on me. Lawyers, topical gag writers, strippers. I mean, most of the stripping industry in Italy will just die with me. And also keep me, because however badly you've behaved in your marriage, you can always say to your partner, well, I'm not as bad as Berlusconi, and you'll get away with it.
OK, that was a relatively convincing case for the bunga bunga one. Rebecca, now will you beg for the life of Vlad the Impaler?
People can be very hard, as you'd know if you'd ever tried to ram a spike through one. And when I was young, I, Vlad, suffered quite badly from asthma. And my school friends, rather than being sympathetic when I was short of breath, gave me the first of many merciless nicknames. They called me Vlad the Inhaler. when I went through that inevitable phase that teenagers do, when I behaved like a wild animal, they gave me another one. They called me Vlad the Impala. And then when I tried to... then when I tried to get healthy and stop myself getting scurvy by eating lots of citrus fruits, Vlad the Unpeeler. So you can see why I did some of the things I did. Now, tyrant is an emotive word. But more than anything, I welcome this opportunity for healthy debate because Cut and Thrust is very much my middle name.
Next up, Dominic, we'd like you to argue to try and retain in existence the one and only Amanda Holden.
You want me to pretend that I'm Amanda
Holden?
Put on
the outfit we gave you, Dominic.
Yeah. Well, I'm very glad this is radio.
So are we. Well, but,
well, if it wasn't for me, Amanda Holden, you...
It's actually uncanny. It's spooky.
It is. If it wasn't for me, Amanda, you wouldn't know that Britain hasn't got any talent. And if it wasn't for me, Amanda Holden, you wouldn't know just how dangerous it is to have Botox. You wouldn't know. And in any case, I mean, what would it be like if everyone who was famous was interesting? I mean... I mean, we never get anything done at all. And besides, if it wasn't for me, Amanda Holden...
She has to make this her actual catchphrase in real life.
So, I mean, I think I've made... I mean, I, Amanda Holden, have made, I think, a compelling case for my existence.
Indeed. Yeah. Thank you, Amanda Holden.
Thank you.
Dave, can you persuade the audience to show mercy to the founder of Scientology, L. Ron Hubbard?
I most certainly can. Without me, L. Ron Hubbard... You might say that Scientology preys on the weak and the emotionally fragile, and I say someone's got to. That's all. And think about the other people in my life. Think about my old mother. My old mother used to be very well fed. But now that I'm not around putting food in her cupboards, old Mother Hubbard is going to those cupboards and finding nothing. Nothing whatsoever. I am the inventor of rock and roll, the inventor of science fiction, the inventor of the Dyson Airblade. I invented this show. Without this show, you're not here to eradicate me from society. You're creating a very dangerous paradox, which is frankly what most of my novels were about.
That was terrifyingly realistic. Now it's time for the audience to vote. So if you'd like to keep that person in history, you cheer loudly, and the person with the lowest volume of cheers will be eradicated completely. So for those who wish to save Silvio Berlusconi, please cheer now.
Did you hear jokes? Did you hear jokes?
It's just derision.
If you get rid of her, there'll be no more
Vlad
horrible
Impala,
puns.
It was class. So, now, cheer, please, if you'd very much like to save Vlad the Impala.
What's wrong with you people?
Now, can you cheer if you'd like to save the one and only Amanda Holden? Yay! Holden, I believe, may be safe. And now, L. Ron Hubbard. Cheer if you'd like L. Ron Hubbard. Yay! Oh, they'd love a bit of L. Ron Hubbard. OK, well, I think it's
outrageous.
Fairly clear. Stop.
Outrageous.
Richard, stay in your seat. Don't walk out. Don't have a tantrum. I'm afraid Silvio Berlusconi is consigned to the bunga-bunga room of history. But on the upside, Italian politics is now no longer a joke. On the downside, we now have the most laughable leader in Europe. So, round three. Round is the Choose Your Own Adventure round, where each panellist is asked to make a choice in turn, with the combined answers weaving their way through a sort of ethical labyrinth, like a regular labyrinth, but without David Bowie in distressing lycra trousers. Start with you, Richard. You're running a marathon for charity, and I know you like to run a marathon.
I do,
you're
I've done
a
that.
Fit, healthy, lithe young man. You're not well, and it's a hot day, really hot day, and you're actually not coping. Your body's sort of failing a bit. Now, your house falls at the halfway mark. And if you stop and you just duck out, then no one is going to know. Honestly, no one is going to find out. So do you? I mean, you are feeling distinctly unwell.
If I'm running for a charity,
yeah,
I think I have to carry on running, even if it means crawling on my hands and knees. So I carry on running.
That's not a sight anyone wants to see. You look like a bike park.
They don't have to look, but I'm going to carry on.
People will still give you the money. No one's going to know. I mean, it's just personal pride that's making you.
I have a lot of personal pride, and I did run a marathon, and I pretty much got halfway running much too fast, and then pretty much did just carry on.
Okay.
So I think I would, you know, I have lived this experience.
All right.
I'd push on through the wall.
So
as we runners call it.
Really?
Yeah, I'm a professional.
I'd use a road.
I ran the marathon in 4 hours, 17 minutes, and 50 seconds, just getting inside the 4 hours, 18 minute barrier that all serious runners are aiming for.
So you are sticking with it. So, yeah. Rebecca, it's 200 yards before the end, and you pass out. You are smack clean gone out. You cannot get to the finish line. And you wake up a few minutes later, and you're in the medical tent, and they make sure you're fine, and you get home. And you're at work the next day. Do you tell people that you didn't actually, even though the intent's there, even though you really wanted to do it, and you pushed, do you tell them you didn't actually finish? They're just handing you money for your charity.
Yeah, you do, I think.
You'd have to tell people.
I think you have to.
I mean, that's embarrassing, isn't it, in a work environment? It's not. It's an open plan office.
Yeah, it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing, but it's not fraud, is it? So it's, on balance, slightly better to be embarrassed than imprisoned, I would say.
But it's for charity. I mean, it's not fraudulent. I mean, it's an element of sort of
fun. I think it is, taking money under false pretences.
All right, so you said that's fine. You said you're going to fess
up. I'm going
to fess
up, yeah.
Well, Dominic, it's now your dilemma, OK? It's nearly £10,000 you've raised, and you look
well
in your bucket.
Done.
Well done.
Thank you.
Well, you did it as well, Richard, to be fair. It was a group effort. £10,000. The problem is when you fess up, you know, people suddenly start saying, actually, do you know what? I'm not going to pay. I'm not going to pay you because, you know, there's a recession on and every single penny in my pocket counts, you know? These difficult times. And you've got 200 quid.
Yeah, I'm feeling quite proud of myself, actually, because I was the fat schoolboy who didn't finish the 100 yards. So
you've done well for yourself.
So, I mean, getting halfway through a marathon, I think the money should come.
They don't take it that way, though. The open plan office isn't just remembering you as a child. You've got photos out.
I can show pictures of me, very fat child, panting.
They've seen those. They went round the office weeks ago. They've already seen those. This is, you know, not the loads of cash in the pocket kind of 1990s. This is austerity Britain, and they don't have the money. And people are being really strict about it. So you had £10,000 raised on paper, but only £200 in real money. So the charity is £9,800 short. Now, what are you going to do? Are you going to just make up the difference yourself?
I think I would have to go to my rich godfather and say, this is a cause. I need your help.
You would not use your own money?
Not my own money, no, because I like that too much.
Yes, but it's your money. It's your money or not?
I think I'd have to pay. I mean, it's a terrible thought, because parting with that money would be physically painful.
OK. So, Dave, the money's been paid to the charity. So, in total, with the £200 you've raised from the slightly disappointed open plan staff at the office, mm-hmm. And the money that's kindly has come out of your collective bank accounts, there's 10 grand. Now, the charity then ring and say, this is amazing. You have become the greatest single fundraiser in that very small charity's history. To mark your achievement, they'd really, really like to do a photo shoot and present you with an award. They're so proud that you completed that race and ran and got all that money. And they'd like you to give a speech involving your involvement with the charity and, you know, talking about what it's like to complete a marathon for them. What do you do? Do you help the charity out there?
I do help the charity out. I accept the speaking invitation, and then I make an impassioned plea in my speech for the fact that there is far too much of this doing stuff for charity. Because actually, when you put your money in the pot, you didn't say, let's see if that man will nearly die running a marathon. You said, yeah, that's a good cause, it's worth my support. And if you're going to say I want my money back, you are evil. That's
wow.
What I do.
That's a hell of a speech covered.
Yeah.
So that's a speech covered, and all you need to do is the photo shoot. Now, I obviously neglected to tell you the charity, which was a very valid charity. It was raising awareness about skin cancer. And the photo shoot is you naked. And all that's covering your modesty is a photocopy of your genitals, but shrunk to 50% of the size. And you're surrounded by Britain's most famously well-endowed sports people.
I have actually done this photo shoot. Many years ago, I did a photo shoot for a calendar, which was for a male testicular. Well, obviously, male
you
testicular.
Think,
there aren't
you
female
just
testicles.
Turned up with your knackers out, and you think.
No.
You think it was for that?
I said yes to it, expecting everyone else to be as unfit as me. There were two categories of people in that weren't me. There were young bucks from Hollyoaks, and there were professional sportsmen. As I left my photo shoot, Greg Rusedski was going in the other way in his prime beefcake years. It was one of the most humiliating things, and my wife has got to the calendar, and every now and then it goes on the kitchen wall to humiliate me. So I've already done this photo shoot, and I think the fact that it's clearly a reduced photocopy, that's a visual joke. Shrinking it, that's comedy, that's okay. I'm okay with that. I'll do that for the good cause.
Fine. Well, that's good to know where we stand. So basically, Richard said he would try and run the marathon. His body gave up and failed, leaving Rebecca with a sad, sorry, soiled mess in a medical tent. She then didn't care who she told about that dreadful debacle, which caused, in turn, the disappointed open-plan inhabitants of that nondescript office where they work to turn and do an avault face and say, we won't pay you, whereupon Dominic said, it's fine, I'll get an ageing relative who buys Nazi memorabilia to stop up the cash. And Dave seems to not care at the end of the day that a charity was involved at all. He just wants another excuse to get his Big John and the Twins out for another photo shoot. So now we come to the final round where we put the team on the spot for a quickfire test of their morality. No time to think about saying the right thing. Just say whatever pops into your head. Pretend for a second you're Prince Philip. So, fingers on buzzers, please. What would you rather have as a pet, a giraffe or Michael Winner? Dominic.
Michael Winner.
Correct. Would you rather taste like crisps, feel like crisps, sound like crisps, or smell like crisps? Dave.
Smell like some really lovely crisps.
Incorrect, they were Wotsits. Would you give up drinking tea if it eradicated thrush? Richard.
Yeah, I would.
Correct. Eat a vegan or be a vegan? Dave.
Eat a vegan.
Is the
and I speak
answer.
As a vegetarian.
Would you read minds if people could read yours too? Dave. Wow, I've no idea you saw me like that. Would you get rid of your worst feature if it means your partner loses the thing you like best about them? Dave.
No.
Is the incorrect answer, I'm afraid. Live in a house made of sticks or a house in Luton? Rebecca.
House made of sticks in Luton.
That is the correct answer. And at the end of the round, and indeed the end of the show, I think we all agree that the moral high ground belongs to Rebecca Front. So the winner gets to sit on a high horse, our losers straddle the wide porcupine of shame. Thank you to the panel for taking part. Thank you so much for listening. Goodbye. That was Dilemma, presented by me, Sue Perkins. It featured Richard Herring, Rebecca Front, Dominic Lawson and Dave Gorman. The script was written by Rodri Crooks, John Luke Roberts, Danielle Ward and Andy Wharton. It was devised by Danielle Ward and the producer was Ed Morrish.
And as I'm sure is obvious, the right thing to do from any perspective would be to tune in again next week for another edition of Dilemma.